This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer John Banville is our guest this afternoon. His new novel is titled Eclipse. It is the story of a successful actor, Alexander Cleve, whose career of 30 years comes to a halt when on stage one night in the middle of the last act, he dies. He forgets his lines and staggers off stage. So Alex Cleve retreats to his boyhood home, abandoning his responsibility to his wife, Lydia, and their troubled daughter, Cass. He heads for the hills to a house his wife says he's never left, a house Cleve says he never fully felt at home in. But it is the place where Cleve will try to confront his ghosts, to find, in his words, whatever it is that has gone wrong with me. A recent article in Esquire offered this description of the book. Seizing a life by its nerve endings, Banville takes us ghosting. Things rustle and creak. The cellar door swings open on guilt, remorse, and betrayal. John Banville was born in Wexford, Ireland. His first book, Long Lankin, was published in 1970. He is the author of 12 books, including The Book of Evidence and The Untouchable. He is a former literary editor for the Irish Times. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for John Banville. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. John Banville, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
How did you begin to conjure Alexander Cleve?
Well, now, that's a difficult question. Where do characters come from? Of course, the honest answer is that they come from the author himself, because, after all, I'm the only material that I have. I can't know people except from the outside. The only one I can know anything about, and that's not very much from the inside, is myself. So, yes, I have to generate these characters out of my inner depths. Where Alexander Cleve came from, I'm not quite sure. I can't. When I look back, I can't find a particular moment at which in which he was conceived. I suppose, in a way, all books spring from other books, and I suppose he came from a long line of first-person narrators that I've been using certainly since the Book of Evidence back in '89.
Why an actor? Why is Alexander Cleve an actor? Why did you make him an actor?
Well, anybody who knows me says, you know, how did it take you so long to write about an actor? Because so many of my characters have admitted that they are performers, and that they're certainly wearing masks, they're certainly wearing personae. I suppose I wanted to, as I've been doing in quite a number of books, to investigate the question of authenticity. How do we live authentically in the world? How do we, first of all, find our true selves, and then how do we express our true selves? And, of course, to give ironic point to the book, it seemed very good to choose an actor to pose these questions, because an actor is the person above all who is not required to have a real self. It's only required to play other parts.
Hmm. Have you done any acting?
Everybody asked me that since this book came out. Well, not professionally, I'll put it that way, but of course I act, as we all do. The poet Philip Larkin, English poet, said that, who never gave a poetry reading in his life, he said that the reason was that he refused to go about the country pretending to be himself. But in a way, if you think about it, this is what we all do. We go about the country pretending to be ourselves.
Mm. In both acting and writing, there are the investigation of character and the telling of stories. Are there other similarities, do you think?
Well, look, I have to confess straight away that I really don't know very much about acting, nor did I know very much about what it felt like to be a murderer when I wrote the Book of Evidence. Or did I know what it was like to be a Cambridge spy when I wrote The Untouchable? Novelists are chameleons. We take on surrounding color, and we do it by force of the imagination. One thinks into oneself and into the subject to such a level where one loses oneself. I know that this sounds like grand romanticism of the late 1800s, but it is true. This is how one writes. Samuel Beckett said that the only progression in art is a progression in depth. In other words, that you can let the river overflow its banks and get wider and wider and wider, and that's easy. But what's the hard part is diving right down to the bottom and finding whatever is on the bottom of the riverbed. And that's what one tries to do. When I sit down to my desk in the morning and face that horrible blank page, I have to, of course, I do all the things that all writers do, you know, sharpening pencils and making another cup of coffee and thinking about something else in order to avoid actually starting. But then one finds oneself having started and sinking down and down and down until time becomes very peculiar at that level of concentration. I remember I was writing one day and I was doing something very difficult, a book that was very difficult in a particular paragraph that day I was working on that was very difficult. And my wife opened my study door and said, "I'm just going out to the shops," and closed the door, and then opened the door and said, "You know, something else." And I said, I thought you were going to the shops. And she said, I've been to the shops. I've come back. Time had telescoped for me. I might say that I was still working on the same line that I'd been working on when she left. But time it gets very strange. And I think that this is one of the attractions of fiction, and I'm sure for artists in general it's one of the attractions, that one can sink down and down, and I suppose at some awful childish level it's an escape from the world and from one's surroundings and from reality.
As you sink down and down, and as you are concentrating, do you become inhabited by the characters that you're creating?
Well, again, this is dangerous territory because one doesn't want to... One has to beware of that kind of mysticism and that kind of deep romanticism. But yes, having said that, yes, the answer is yes, of course I do. I found in this book, and I suppose one of the, I mean, to go back to the original question, I suppose one of the reasons I chose to have an actor as my protagonist is that I wanted a rhetorical tone. I wanted the reader to have an image of an actor standing alone on stage in the spotlight, striking a heroic pose and speaking rhetorically and saying lots and lots of things in order to avoid saying the things that he... In order to avoid... it's difficult. In order to avoid having to try to say all the things that he can't say. In other words, as I say, striking an attitude, striking a pose. He's not like a novelist in that he... I mean, actors, I presume, and I have to confess, I know very little about the theatre, but I presume that actors inhabit a character. I mean, one actor that I know has told me, and I was absolutely astonished by this, that while he's acting, he can think about other things. He can think about the household accounts or what he's going to have for his dinner or, you know, what the critics said about him in the last few reviews. And, of course, when I thought about it, I realized that this it would have to be the case, because an actor simply could not come into the theater every night and play himself over and over and over again. You would have to have a critical distance from it, a saving distance from the part that you're playing. So Alexander Cleve, I suppose, is in a way stepping out of his role as an actor to try to speak his own personality. And I suppose the pathos of the book, if it has pathos, is that he fails in that.
You really take us inside Alexander Cleve, his memories, his dreams. We see his ghosts. He didn't mourn the deaths of his parents. He's not a very good husband. His daughter is a troubled young woman, and at one point he asks himself about his daughter. Is she 22 or is she 23?
Yes, but I think all fathers know that experience. Mothers always know the ages of their children. Fathers don't. It doesn't make them particularly bad.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, not an interruption at all. And his dreams are, they can be on the spooky side. But as a reader, I don't dislike him.
Well, of course, I mean, I think that if, you know, to understand is to forgive all, it's a sentiment I've never quite believed in, but I suppose to a certain extent it's true. If you know any poor, failed creature intimately, I think that you will inevitably feel compassion, not even pity, but compassion, which is much stronger and deeper emotion. Because, I mean, I know that when the book came out on the other side of the Atlantic, the first interview I did, the first interviewer, and the first thing she said to me was, and it was a she said, you know, I'm Alexander Cleeve. And she wasn't being histrionic or trying to take over the book. She simply said, you know, I feel that you've expressed something that I've always felt and couldn't articulate. And of course, that's one of the greatest compliments you can have as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite surprised by that kind of remark. I've been quite surprised by the reception for this book. I thought it would sink like a stone. I thought people would absolutely hate it. I thought people would just hate Alexander Cleeve's tone of voice from the very beginning, and that they wouldn't stick with it, and that they would say, I just detest this person. And I've been doing a reading tour of the States, and last night I had a very good audience, and there was a question and answer session afterwards, and there was a woman sitting in the front row, and she complimented me on the book and said how beautifully it was written and so on. But she then went on to say, but I'm so sick of these books in which men, you know, hate women, you know, excuse themselves and confess all. And I saw exactly what she meant. I mean, I was far more sympathetic to her than I think she thought I would be, because I regard Alexander Cleeve as a bit of a cad, a bit of a bounder. I suppose he's a monster, but he's such a pathetic monster mm-hmm. that you can't help feeling sorry for him mm-hmm. in his awful predicament.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the awful predicament of not being able to feel, not being able to see what's going on around him, not being able to figure out how to live life. All he can do is act. And, of course, throughout the book, the verb to act is used with all its heavy ambiguities. You know, it's such an ambiguous term. In the same way that his own name is so ambiguous. I mean, Cleeve is one of my favorite words in the English language. It means two diametrically opposed things. And to act, in Cleeve's sense, also means diametrically opposed things. To act, in Cleeve's sense, means not to act at all. It means to do nothing.
Hmm. How do you suppose Cleeve's wife and daughter feel about him?
I think they love him, as women always seem to love the most awful scoundrels. It's his wife. It's easy for me to talk about because I think that, and curiously again, a few people have seen that she's one of the most important people in the book, even though she appears very, very rarely. But she is the carrier of wisdom. She knows what's wrong with poor old Alexander Cleeve, mm-hmm. even though he doesn't know what's wrong. But she can't tell him because it's so simple. And, it's like trying to explain life to... It's like trying to explain human life to a creature from outer space. You know, look, she wants to say to him, Alex, this is how it's done. But you can't. You cannot explain how to live to people who don't know how to live. As to his daughter, that is more difficult for me to answer because the book I'm writing at the moment is, in a way, the story of his daughter. It's Cass's story, at least the story of the last months of her life. And I'm not sure... It's funny to carry a character over from one book into another one. I mean, I didn't really intend to write, I won't say a sequel, but I didn't intend to write a companion novel to this one. But I was so interested in Cass and I was so interested in her tragedy. And I felt that she had not, that her ghostly presence in Eclipse, I felt that I hadn't finished with her.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me to know, but I think that there is a deep, deep, deep bond between Alexander Cleve and Cass. I think some of the most moving passages in the book, I mean, I feel moved by them, and I wasn't moved by them when I was writing them, are to do with his difficult, strained relations with Cass, especially when she was a child.
Mm-hmm.
I did a reading, the first reading that I did from the book in Dublin when it was published, I read a section about him dealing with Cass, and I, to everybody's astonishment, including my own, I still got all choked up toward the end of the reading, and I didn't realize that I cared as much about these characters. And this is a sort of awful confession for me, because I like to think that I am entirely distanced from the work. I am a follower of T.S. Eliot, who said that the artist, the man, the human being who suffers and the artist who creates are entirely two entirely separate beings. So it's always a shock when you find the stuff that you've done yourself actually affecting yourself.
There's a, speaking of the relationship between Alex Cleve and his daughter Cass, there's a scene that I'm recalling right now that really moved me, where she's a little girl and I believe she's been ice skating and she falls and hurts herself.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's painful.
It is, isn't it? Yes. Yes, I think the scenes with her when she's small are quite moving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because sort of I don't do moving for the most part. You know? it's not my thing. But I think that she as a character snuck up on me in the way that she sneaks up on poor Alex and sort of surprises him with the depth of his feeling for her. And she surprised me with the depth of my feeling for her. I don't want to get carried away here. I mean, these are creatures, not of flesh and blood. They're made out of words. But still, they seem to have a resonance on the page.
Hmm. The book has the feel of memoir or perhaps monologue delivered in a stream of consciousness. And Cleve is... He's an actor, and he's very actorly. Do you think of the book as memoir or as monologue?
Well, it's a monologue, of course. I mean, it's one man speaking. Memoir, I don't know. I think it's a funny book. As you can hear by my inarticulacy, I find it a hard book to talk about because I don't quite understand it myself. It surprised me in many ways. It was only when I came to read it in proofs, when I was correcting it long after I'd finished writing the book, that I saw how peculiarly dreamlike it was, that strange drift that it has. It's not an effect that I intended, but it's there. But I suppose he is trying to... He is trying to confess rather than remembering. His memories, as they come to him, they seem to press upon him rather than being... He doesn't summon them up. It's as if he is summoned up by his memories.
Mm.
And the past weighs very heavily on him, and even the future weighs very heavily on him, even though he doesn't realize it.
Would you tell us something about the ghosts in Cleve's life and the role they play in the novel?
Yes, well, that's a bit tricky because the novel has a kind of twist in the end. You don't quite know what's coming. He is certainly in this. He goes back to the house where he grew up. He's living there alone, he thinks. He discovers that, in fact, he's not living alone. He's sharing it with both corporeal and incorporeal creatures who gradually invade his life. You see how careful I'm being. In a way, I think that the living creatures that he finds he's sharing the house with are in their peculiar way almost as ghostly as the ghosts that he's sharing the house with. But again, I was taken by surprise by the character of Lily, who is the daughter of the agent who has rented him the house, or who is taking care of the house, caretaker of the house.
Quirk.
Quirk, yeah. And Lily sort of took me by surprise because I didn't intend to have this rather Lolita-esque, hoydenish creature. And I kind of fell in love a little bit with Lily, this awful sort of, what is she? She says she's 17, but she's actually 15. And even though, again, like Lydia, the wife, she's not in it very much, she has a presence that is disproportionate to the number of lines that she's given in the book. So that you would think at the start of the book, and I suppose the reader's heart would quail a bit at the prospect of 220 pages or whatever of this guy speaking, but as the book goes on, very quickly, in fact, his solitude is invaded by living creatures and by creatures who may be living elsewhere, but who form a ghostly presence. Mm. So that he, having thought he could get away from people, he is, in fact, living much more intimately with people than he had been for a long time. And this may be some kind of help to him.
Another of your books is titled Ghosts.
Yes, I was sorry I'd used up that title. Good for this one.
I am unfamiliar with your other work, I'm sorry to say, and I will search it out now, but I was wondering, you know, what your thoughts are about ghosts.
Well, in the novel Ghosts, which appeared before, that's about, my God, I've written too many books, it's appeared about 3 books ago, that book is quite like this one in many ways, in that you never know whether the people you're reading about are actually there or not there. I think that my increasing, my increasing interest in ghostliness seems to be to do with the fact that I've spent so much of my life, you know, I've been writing since I was 12 years old, 40, 45 years of dealing with ghosts every day. I mean, to be a novelist is a very strange occupation. You have breakfast with a family, and there's all the stuff of family life. Then you go in, you shut the door, and you sit down at your desk, and you enter this world, which is composed of another world entirely, with other skies and another climate and other people and other names. And it's as if you had been asleep and you'd been having these very, very vivid dreams. Then you get up, you have breakfast in the waking world, and then you go back into the room and start dreaming again, but in a slightly different way. I mean, for instance, to say I'm not a morning person is a wild understatement. You know, I can barely tie my shoelaces before noon, but I can write from 8 or 9 in the morning, and I think that what it is that my mind is half of my mind is still in that dream world.
Mm.
And that's where fiction, I think, comes from. When I was younger, 20 years ago, I would have been very indignant at the suggestion that there's anything dreamlike about fiction. But now, the older I get, and the more I dream, and the more weighty the dreams become, the more I realize that it is very, very like the process of what's called creative writing. I mean, Nietzsche is right when he says that every man is an artist in his dreams. And I suspect that I'm simply doing something that... I mean, I have the great luxury of not having to wake up and go to a real daytime, daylight, adult job. I can actually go back again.
I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought there because there was an interruption there on the phone line. But let me try and go back to this. I wanted to make a comment on this idea of writing is existing in a dream. It's not unlike the automatic writing of the surrealists, I guess.
No, it's not really. I mean, I couldn't go that far.
No.
I mean, I used, if you let go control of what you're doing, then you have no control, and loss of control in art is, I think, disastrous, absolutely disastrous. The notion that writing is in some way, that writing fiction is in some way a sort of stream of consciousness, self-expression, is anathema to me. I hate that notion. I think it's lazy, and I think it's silly, and I think it's wrong. The artist is always, always, always in control, and if he's not, the art is going to be bad. But I have a different definition of control now to what I had 25 years ago when I was writing a novel based on the life of Kepler, the astronomer Kepler, back in the late 70s. I planned it to the last. I mean, Kepler was a great numerologist. He really believed that the world was run on a mathematical system. And I based the book on a completely controlled mathematical system, so that I would write, each section was dictated by a mathematical quotient. And it was a way of working, and it was one of the tensions in the book was the way in which the human scale of the life of the astronomer was in conflict with the mathematical structure that I had placed on the book. But that, I couldn't work like that now. Now I have to let my instincts, I have to be very careful here, I have to let my instincts have their say. But I am still in control, and it would be foolish to say I'm not. I mean, I'd love to be able to do it. I'd love to be able to sit down at my desk and let the automatic writing come. You know, apart from anything else, I'd finish a book in about 3 or 4 days rather than 5 years, which is the norm.
Yeah. You know. Well, it wouldn't be very rewarding then either, would it?
Rewarding in what sense?
In
We're not talking money here, are we?
I mean, in terms of feeling an accomplishment, feeling that you've done something, that you know.
Yeah, but the feeling of having done something is mostly fraught with guilt. I mean, it's, you know, I remember George Steiner writing to me years ago when he was bringing out a piece of fiction, and he said to me, I've perpetrated a fiction. And I think, in a way, I think all artists feel, you know, Beckett said, and it's partly true, he said, failure in art is like, the artist dares fail like no other dares fail. Now, I think that it's not quite good enough if you think about a sportsman, for instance. I mean, somebody running a race, you either lose or you win. There's no halfway. If you fail, you fail. But what Beckett is talking about is personal failure. And to be an artist is to fail at every moment that one is working. Martin Amis has said, and it's absolutely true, it's a true metaphor that, I mean, it's true figuratively, that any page of prose is a testament to about 2,000 misjudgments. And that is true. I mean, if you try to work in something as recalcitrant as language or paint or sound, I mean, you know, every artist has the same experience, that it is constantly to fall short of what you've started out to do. So that what you're left with when you finish, you know, if it takes 3 months to write a novel or 5 years to write a novel, what you're left with at the end is a record of of your own failures. I mean, this is an appalling vista. When you start out writing a book, your mind knows very well that it's going to be another botched job at the end, but your heart tells you, no, this is going to be the one that's going to be absolutely perfect. This is going to be the one that will... Everybody else will lay down their pens after this, because there'll be no point in writing after this book. Because in order to keep oneself going through the process of writing, even a short book, I mean, the Newton letter which I wrote back in the 80s, it's 80 pages long. It took 2 years to write. So, you know, quantity and quality are entirely separate where art is concerned. So that one has to keep oneself going by lying to oneself about the possibilities. But I think any artist who regards his own work with anything less than, well, embarrassment at least, is deeply suspect.
I wonder, you know, you said earlier, a few minutes ago, that, you know, you thought that this book would sink like a stone. How do you keep from just putting it in the drawer and forgetting about it then?
Well, you have to remember that books are written not for an audience, but for oneself. I mean, every writer knows this. There are two versions of the book. There's the version that you write, and there's the version that you have written. Once it's finished, it becomes something else that publishers take up and reviewers take up, and it's an entirely different organism to this extraordinary creature that you were grappling with for 5 years. This thing that had its claws sunk in your throat for 5 years. Suddenly the claws relax, the creature slinks off and becomes somebody else's creature, you know, the publishers or the publicists or the reviewers or whatever. So one takes a somewhat distanced view. This is one of the reasons that artists, that novelists, find it so hard to talk about their work. And that the work that they're talking about is usually, it's always the past.
Mm-hmm.
The past for me. You know, and of course I couldn't talk about the book that I am working on because, well, you don't know it, nobody else knows it, and I don't want to talk about it because I don't want to interfere with it. So it's a hard life being a novelist. Oh, artists love to whinge and whine.
Dreadful, really. I imagine that Eclipse was particularly difficult to write. It's so intense. As I quoted from that article in Esquire, you know, the writer of that article said you've seized a life by its nerve endings.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in that book. But I have a slightly baffled attitude to it, in that every book is terribly difficult to write. I mean, despite the fact that we whinge and whine, I mean, sometimes we are justified in whinging and whining, but as I said earlier, language is such a recalcitrant medium. It simply will not. It's like trying to get... I mean, it's a very old dog, and you cannot teach it new tricks. It just sits there on its haunches and says, I am not going to move. You can pull on that leash all you like, I am not going to move. And then you persuade it in some way, and it moves a little bit, and you get maybe a sentence. And then you push a little bit further, you pull a little bit more, and it moves a little bit further, and then you get a paragraph. And this is an incredibly difficult process. And always at the end of the day, that damned hound will go back and squat on its haunches again and say, tomorrow I will be just as bad. In fact, I'll be worse. I won't even, you know, I will refuse to move for you. So there's a daily struggle. And God knows why we do it. I mean, that's silly. One does it because every now and then there is an absolutely beautiful golden chime will come from a line or a sentence that one has written. And usually it's a sentence that a reader won't notice because it's not particularly colorful or weighty or significant. It's just close as one could have hoped what one set out to do. I know that's a complicated sentence, but it's a complicated process. I mean, I spoke earlier of the Newton Letter, which is a book I wrote back in the 80s, about 80 pages, very short. It's my favorite book, not because I think it's my best book. I'm not in a position to say which is my best book. Or, you know, that's not my job. But it's my favorite because it is as close in its... The execution of it is as close to the conception of it that I've ever got. It's as near to being what I set out to do. And there are... I never look at my own work unless I'm absolutely forced to. And I was looking through the Newton Letter because it's to do with film stuff and so on. And I had to glance through it, and I was really quite taken again with the extraordinary notion that I had actually got quite a few sentences in that book that were as near to being right as I've ever got. A strange sensation. And I look back on something like Eclipse, which is, you know, the nearest book to me in time. And I can't say that I hate it. I mean, Orwell's work is an embarrassment because it's all wrong. I mean, everything is wrong about it from my point of view, because it's nowhere near that golden, unworldly, otherworldly conception that I had at the start. But no, I thought that it would. I didn't think that people would see Eclipse as having any relevance, a great buzzword nowadays. I didn't feel that people would feel that this was speaking to their lives or how they lived. And yet lots of people came to me and said, yes, I know exactly how Alexander Klee feels. It makes me think that the world is in far more trouble than I thought it was. If everybody feels this poor creature is them, then the species is in bad shape.
Is there a line from Eclipse that you could offer us as an example of a sentence that you really like in this book?
Well, I could read you a short paragraph,
that
which
would
I
be,
like. I mean, it doesn't mean anything, but it's just I like the cadence of it. It's very near the start, it's in, you know, two or three pages in, and he's talking about the way in which he, by accident, found himself back at the house where he was born. He's in deep trouble, and he's sort of driving at random through the country. And this is just a little moment of accidental discovery. And I'll just read it for you, just to give you a sense of how it sounds from my side. The house itself it was that drew me back, sent out its secret summoners to bid me come home, I was going to say. On the road, one winter twilight, an animal appeared in front of the car, cowering and yet fearless seeming, sharp teeth bared and eyes flashing in the glare of the headlamps. I had stopped on instinct before I registered the thing, and sat aghast now, smelling mephitic fumes of tire smoke and listening to my own blood hammering in my ears. The animal made a movement as if to flee, then stopped still again. Such fierceness in that stare, the electric eyes, an unreal neon red. What was it? Weasel? Ferret? Too big for these, yet not big enough for fox or dog. Just some wild, unknown thing. Then, at a low run, seemingly legless, silently, it was gone. My heart was pounding yet. The woods leaned inward on either side of me, blackly brown against the last faint radiance of the dying day. For miles, I had been travelling in a kind of sleep, and now I thought I was lost. I wanted to turn the car around and drive back the way I had come, but something would not let me go. I switched off the headlights and struggled out and stood on the road, the damp half-darkness folding me about, making me its own. From this low hill, the twilight land ahead fell away into shadow and mist. An unseen bird above me in the branches gave a cautious croak. A wafer of ice in the wet verge snapped glassily under my heel. When I sighed, an ectoplasmic flaw of breath stood in front of me briefly like a second face. I walked forward to the brow of the hill and saw the town then, its few little glimmering lights, and beyond, the fainter glimmer of the sea, and I knew where, unknowingly, I had come to. I went back and got behind the wheel again and drove to the top of the hill, and there I switched off the engine and the lights and let the car roll down the long incline in bumping silence, dreamily, and stopped in the square before the house, standing in its darkness, deserted, its windows all unlit, all unlit.
Hmm.
It doesn't mean a damn thing, you know, but it's... The cadences seem to me right.
Yeah.
And it was one of the first paragraphs I wrote in the book where I thought, now I think I have some idea of where I'm going. Because the first pages of a book are extremely important, not only for the novelist, but for the reader as well. Because in a way, when you pick up a novel, if it has any real worth, any real artistic worth, you have to learn how to read in a completely new way. You have to learn how to read specifically for this particular work. We all do that. We all recognize that. We all acknowledge that when we pick up a poem. But mostly we think, well, a novel is going to speak to us in what we speak, like the character in Molière, who's thrilled to discover that he's been speaking prose all his life. Readers think, well, you know, I speak prose. I've been doing it all my life. This is prose as well. So where's the problem? And the novelist has to say to the reader, look, the prose that you speak and the prose that I speak and the prose that we think in is different to the stuff that's on this page, because this has been worked over for so long and so deeply and has been burnished to such a high sheen that it's not like the prose that we're used to. So you must give it a different... You must read it at a different pace. You mustn't... You must let it set its own pace in your mind.
We're growing short on time. Mm-hmm. Before we go, I want to ask you a question that... Well... It's about the art for the book jacket. Was it done for the book?
No, I think it's a painting by some European painter. I couldn't quite... when they sent it to me, I couldn't quite figure it out. The first thing I noticed, of course, was that for people who haven't seen it, it's a man in his pajamas and an overcoat outdoors walking into the face of a very high wind, and he's carrying a candlestick with a candle in it, and everything is blowing backwards, and he's holding onto his head almost so that it won't blow off. But the candle flame is perfectly
right, straight.
This is the first thing I fixed on. And then I thought, well, of course, that must be intentional. The artist would not have done that unless it was intentional. And I suppose, really, as every time I saw it, as I said, at first I was quite baffled by it. I regard people who do book designs and book covers as kind of alchemists, you know. One almost never meets them. They seem to labor in alchemical dungeons somewhere, and they come up with these extraordinary images. But as I looked at this again and again, I began to see that there was an extraordinary pathos about that upright candle flame. That it did express something about the book that I hadn't known was there. So, you know, it would be nice to think that the designers in the book were listening to this program, because I would like to pay them the compliment of saying that they wrought a little work of art of their own simply by choosing this picture.
It's a great cover.
No, it is good.
Yeah.
No, I'm very lucky in having... I mean, you know, we bewail the state of literacy these days and the state of the book trade and everything else, and I do it as well. I was literary editor of the Irish Times for 10 years, and I was constantly bewailing the declining standards and so on. But every now and then one has to stand back and say that the standards in certain areas are still incredibly high. We live in a very meritorious time, but there are still people who can make beautiful books. I mean, coming from Europe, certainly from England and Ireland, and this is where I hope my English publisher is not listening to this program, the books are really quite ugly. And, well, I won't say ugly, but they're carelessly done. books in America, so it's just so beautifully made. I go into a bookshop, and I almost faint from pleasure. It's just the sight of these books. I want to buy them all. Anyway, that's a slight digression, but it's a nice cover, and it's peculiarly moving in its way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that cover, and then when you open the cover and begin reading, you're done for.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It's the best compliment I've had in a long time.
Thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
John Banville has been my guest here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. We've been talking about his book, Eclipse, which is just out from John Banville. And let me mention, too, that John Banville is on tour in the U.S., and next week, next Thursday evening, he'll be at Barbara's Bookstore in Chicago for a reading and book signing that's set for 7:30. Eclipse, John Banville.